Yowes Kano, welcome to Wampum.codes. I'm your host, Amelia Winger Bearskin. On Wampum.codes, I interview Indigenous and Native artists and technologists, VR directors, activists, teachers, and incredible inspiring people who are making positive change in their community. We are brought to you with generous support from MIT Co-Creation Studio and the Mozilla Foundation. I have an incredible guest with me today that I've known for a little while, and I will love to have them introduce themselves.
Tanake, Niat, Leslin, George Warren, Niat, Ni Temperu, Yaksuna, Wanda, George Warren, Tate, Wanabak, George, Ye Iswara, Ye Katabare, Ye Kampi Sawachahare, Hawo Manuke Katabare, Hawo Amelia Winger Bearskin. Hello, my name is DeLeslin George Warren, but everyone has called me Roo since I was a fetus, Roo like kangaroo, so that's how most people refer to me. I'm a citizen of Catawba Nation. We are the only federally recognized tribe in South Carolina and one of two in North Carolina. I gave a traditional introduction, so I told you a little bit about my family. My mother was our tribal administrator for almost a decade. My grandfather was our assistant chief for almost 30 years. And then I told you a little bit about what I do. So in Catawba, we don't differentiate between teachers and artists, because if you are, for example, a potter, which is our longest unbroken traditions, archaeologists tell us that we have one of the longest pottery traditions in what we now call the United States. If you're a potter, then you're also de facto a teacher. And so education and art to me are deeply intertwined. And so you see that in the work that I do nowadays. A lot of my work is about research-based practice and performance, but also providing educational resources in my community. I live on my reservation in South Carolina, which is where I'm talking to you from right now. So I gave thanks to the land, the Catawba land. And of course, I gave thanks to you, Amelia Winger Bearskin, which to your lovely podcast listeners, they may not know this, but at one point you were a professor at a top 20 university, which is where I met you, because I was a student there at Vanderbilt University, and you were the only Native American professor I had during my entire undergraduate career. And my time with you, I mean, maybe we can get more into it later, but it was deeply formative to my practice today. So I'm just so thankful to be on this podcast, to have this conversation with you, and just to catch up and see what's been happening.
I couldn't imagine. I mean, I would just love to hear so much about everything you've been up to since the last time I saw you in person, or the last kind of online catch-ups we've done. And I'm so blessed that I get to have you as a guest, and I'm really glad that other people get to hear all the amazing things that you're doing as well. As your former teacher, I could wish nothing more than to share your beautiful light with everyone I know.
So, I'm so glad. Well, thank you. That's so nice. So nice.
Well, I mean, you know, we're nice.
That's who we are.
Yeah. Well, oh my gosh. You sent me incredible links to catch me up to where you are today. And there are so many wonderful places to start. But you know, you were talking about pottery and about how there's no differentiation between an artist and a teacher, which I just, you know, I really agree with that in general in a lot of ways. And I also think the maybe the best thing about being an artist can be being a teacher. And that doesn't mean to say that all art is like the highest aspiration that I would want for teaching, what a goal to get us there, right?
So, well, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd love for you to maybe talk about how you too have also been a really great teacher through your art. And maybe you'd want to talk about a little bit of the work that you're doing with teaching through art, but also teaching pretty directly, people connecting to the Catawba language and to your culture as well.
Yeah, well, I had this conversation with one of my friends who is at Vanderbilt right now as a graduate student in the Divinity School, but they've done a lot of work in education. And one of the things we were talking about is like, why are there so many demands for such little compensation for public school educators? And on top of that, why do we not compensate them for doing community-based research? Like, how amazing would it be if if our educators in our public school system were also being paid to do this kind of research. And to me, like, again, from this cultural perspective, that is, you, to me, it's like the being just a quote unquote educator is missing a really big part of it, which is that you need to be intellectually involved. You need to be intellectually curious. And then that's what you're bringing to your students, right? We kind of reserve that sort of attitude for university level, college level educators, but it really should be a part of everyone who is working with people, with educating people. So I, you know, just reflecting on what you were just saying, you know, I think that might be something that we could really bring in from our tribal communities into the public education system as a new approach. But, So in my community, I came back here in 2017, partly as a response to the election of 2016. I was in DC. I'd moved there after college to, you know, quote unquote, change the world and realize that's not what happens in Washington, DC. And so after the election of Donald Trump, I decided to move back to my community in South Carolina, which is the heart of Trump country, which in retrospect was maybe not the most logical thing to do. But I was also given a language grant at the time from Running Strong for American Indian Youth, which is this really incredible program started by Billy Mills, who is one of two Native people to ever receive gold medals at the Olympics. And so he's dedicated his work to supporting the dreams of young people. And so basically everyone who gets this grant is working on a dream that they have for their community. And my dream was to really kickstart this revitalization of Catawba language. So some backstory, our last native speaker of Catawba, the last person who grew up speaking Catawba and was fluent in it, he passed away in 1961. That was also the year that it became official, according to the federal government, that we were quote unquote terminated, which is just the name of that policy sounds so violent. And I wish that this was just a euphemism that I was using, but it's literally how the federal government referred to this policy, which was basically where they went into tribes and said, you're no longer a tribe because we think you're quote unquote civilized enough. And so in termination, we lose our nation to nation relationship with the federal government, which means that we no longer have access to resources that the government has. And so from 1961 until 1993, where we regained our federal recognition thanks to a really hard fight by our leaders. In that time period, we had no resources for language education. And when you think about the immense amount of resources that are put into to English education in the United States, you know, we recognize that you do need to put in money to teach language. But the United States, for every dollar it's spent on destroying languages through the boarding school system, they've spent less than 7 cents on language revitalization. And so even once we were recognized again, it's still an uphill battle to get the resources that we need. But when we were doing this battle for federal restoration, for federal recognition again, we did these big surveys of our community and we said, what is important to you in the culture? And people said pottery, because again, that's the thing that has never ended. It has never been broken. And people said language, because they could still feel it. Like people who were children when our last speaker was alive can still remember him speaking Catawba, and they knew that it was something really essential to us. So from the 90s into the 2000s and into the 2010s, we were working on language, but I saw that we had this opportunity with this huge boom in technology to really address some of the deepest needs for language revitalization in my community. So I got this grant. I started working on curricula. I started working on working with our childcare programs to bring language in there. But I also worked on our digital infrastructure around language. So that includes social media, but it also includes our web app, catawbalanguage.org, that I've been developing for the last few years. And I am not at all a developer in the sense that I went to school for it or have any formal education in it. But I just knew that it was something that we needed to address. Actually, the moment that I realized it was something we needed to address was when I was looking at some other tribes who have some non-English characters in their language they all were saying to me, honestly, the first step was creating a keyboard so that people were able to type in that language. Like, that was kind of the first step. And I had, awesome. I was like, okay, I don't know all that much about coding, but I think I can make a keyboard. And so I got the grant and I started working on the keyboard. From there, people were like, we'd love some games online. And so I started working on that. They were like, oh, we'd love like an online dictionary. And so that's kind of where we are right now in our language project. But in addition to that, I've also been working on food sovereignty in my community and just a bunch of other sovereignty related projects with our tribal government.
Well, that's incredible. And it's really wonderful to hear your journey, both with connecting to looking at how you can preserve language, encouraging others and teaching, and then using new media to do it, which, mm-hmm. you know, has its own like difficulties and non-difficulties. You know, some things are easy and some other things are hard. What ways have you found have been the easiest ways to engage with people of diverse ages or different levels with language? Because I know there's so many different kind of ways of approaching it. And I have other friends who are kind of looking at the same thing. I would love to hear how you've solved some of those kind of basic problems of just getting people to enjoy learning and getting excited and encouraging them.
Yeah, one of the biggest barriers, particularly for the older generations in language learning, is that they were raised in a grammatical approach to English education. And what I mean by that is that they were raised with the idea that there are correct ways to speak English and there are incorrect ways to speak English. And so they bring that kind of posture towards language to Catawba. The reality is we've had linguists coming to our community since the 1700s. So we had, you know, like five in the 1700s, 10 in the 1800s, and two in the 1900s. And when you look at English over that time period, there were just such drastic changes. And so the most common conversation I have, particularly with older people, you know, middle-aged and older, is how do I say this? And my response is kind of, you know, more of a postmodern response of like, okay, well, you could say it this way. This is how I might say it. There's also this way of saying it. And people repeatedly are like, no, I want to know the right way to say it. But language is always a creative act, right? It's always a creative act. And with kids, they get it. They're there. They're ready to play with the language. You know, it's like Play-Doh to them. With older people, they think of it more like building a house. And that is just not going to work for us because, first off, like I said, our last speaker died in 1961. And so the language was not being created anew. In that time period, think of the immense number of changes that have happened in society. And the language was not changing with those changes. So we don't have words right. for like television, we don't have words for internet, we don't have words for cell phone. All these things that are essential to the way that our life is structured nowadays. And there is some resistance amongst older folks in my community to the need for playfulness, to the need for creativity in language revitalization. Whereas with younger people, they're just all about it. Like, I remember having a conversation with a kid the other day and was like, they're like, what's the word for cell phone? And the kid, and then so I responded to this kid, I was like, oh, you know, we didn't really have one because our last person passed away before there were cell phones. And I was like, what would you call a cell phone in the language? And they were like, oh, well, maybe like a rock hand. And I was like, a rock hand? And they said, yeah, it's like a rock that you hold in your hand.
That's amazing.
And I was like, sure, let's go with that. Like, why not?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I remember when I was hanging out in the kitchen with my friend, Wendy Redstart, and we were talking to her dad, and he was talking about, oh yeah, well the, you know, the crow word for cat is mountain lion dog. And I was like, that makes total sense, right? Because before contact, you had mountain lions, which is the closest thing to like a cat, like a house cat, and you had dogs, and the dogs are pets. So if you have like a pet that's a cat, it's a mountain lion dog. And I was like, yeah, that makes 100%
of course
sense,
of
right?
Course
yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, just like a rock that you hold in your hand. I mean, like,
that's
you know, totally. And we were always like, we have always been reinventing our language. That's what language is. It's just a way of communicating in the moment, connecting, taking your culture and giving it to another person and receiving it. And so we, I'm sure, for thousands of years have been inventing words about a new thing that we discover, that you hold in your hand, right?
Well, of course. And I think about, like, when you look at the linguistic history of web technologies, like, you see it in action. Like, for maybe 10, 15 years, there was this, like, is it the World Wide Web? Is it the internet? Like, what is this thing that we're all becoming more and more reliant on, more and more interacting with? And no one sat down and said, you know what, we're going to call it the internet. It was just through the social process that we kind of all decided, you know what, World Wide Web, no, it's internet.
Yeah, and no one is like talking about surfing the web anymore, right? Like that used to be a thing, like, oh, we're surfing the internet. You're like, yeah, no one says that anymore. Unless you want to watch like old infomercials, in which case that's amazing. But like, you know. Right,
you know, do it. Like I would love to see the installation.
Like we could bring it back. I mean, it's okay.
We can make it cool again.
Yeah, we can make it cool again. Or like ask your kids like, yeah, well, how would you describe what you do online in Catawba language? That would be amazing. I mean,
well, yeah. And that is part of what we're working on is getting with people individually to talk about like, how would you express this? And one of the things that feels most important to me is going to these various communities within my tribe and asking them like how they want to self-identify. So for example, one of the things I talk about is almost every single linguist that has ever come and worked with us or worked on us, right? Because the history of linguistics and anthropology has not necessarily been centered around the desires of the community. And so I think about like all of these European and American white men who came into our communities and were doing these, language inventories. And I can just so vividly see this situation where in the 1700s, like some English speaking guy comes into our community and we're matriarchal, but I can imagine him coming into our community and being like, okay, what's the word for woman? And we're like, oh, yeah. And then he writes it down. And that's his only question about femininity in our community. He doesn't explore further, right?
Right.
Whereas meanwhile, us, we're like, oh, there's so much depth there. I just know that there's so much language there that has been lost because this European was so stuck in his patriarchal worldview that information did not get transferred through this documentation to us. And so what I always say is, you know, we can either sit here and be sad about what we lost, which is important. We need to mourn cultural loss. But we also have to decide, you know what, we're going to make some decisions now and we're going to think creatively for the next generation. Because all tradition, all culture has its first day on the job, right? We all, at some point, the most sacred song to us at some point had to be sung for the first time.
Right. And it probably wasn't like as good as, you know, it is now.
Right.
Like, it's okay.
And over time, there's iteration, right? Yeah. There's iteration and revision, and that's beautiful. That's the work of community, right?
Absolutely.
So for us, like people, for a long time, I was identifying as Two-Spirit. I feel less comfortable with that at the moment. Like I think I identify more like Indigiqueer, but what I'm working with. Yeah, isn't it cool?
I like that. Oh my God. Hashtag Indigiqueer.
Yes.
I love it.
It's so good. All My Relations are All Our Relations podcast with Dr. Adrian Keene.
Yes, totally. Totally. Love that.
Matika Wilbur, they had a great podcast about Two-Spirit and Indigiqueer identities. So I'd encourage people to go and listen to that. But coming to my community, I think that the reason I don't feel comfortable with Two-Spirit is it still feels like pan-Indigenous in a way that I don't feel comfortable with. Like,
oh my God, thank
I want to figure
I'm
out
so what... Glad. I'm so glad that I feel like I've had this feeling and I haven't, I mean, I've been really like a fly on the wall in other people's conversations and I've been like, I agree with that one, but I've been pretty quiet, but I have, I have felt like the two, cause people have asked me, they're like, do you identify as Two-Spirit? And I'm like, well, you know, my tribe didn't really have that word. And so I'm not sure like what I'm co-signing, I guess, by saying yes or no. Yeah. I'm an Indigenous queer person, but that you know, we all had different ways of describing it, and that has changed throughout time, and we've lost some of the ways in which we talked about that. And sometimes we're getting them back. I have a lot of incredible, like, queer members of my community that are rediscovering the language and doing similar work to you and saying, actually, and interrogating, like, okay, some people said this is how it was used, but this is how it's defined. So we're kind of like our own detectives, right? And going back and rediscovering what we think, but some of it is really going to come through our own lens and our own opinions. It's kind of awesome, you know?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's, it's about, like, I mean, and I think a lot of it was also Two-Spirit coming out of this context of a lot of queer Native people really, for safety reasons, having to exit their communities and go to urban communities. There's no judgment in that. Like, that was how they had to survive in that context. And in that context, it was more essential to build solidarity across tribal boundaries, to create a queer indigenous community in these urban centers. For me, like, something that I feel is very important is being a queer person back in my rural tribal community and to reimagine how I can, how we can rebuild the circle of our community, and I can re-enter the social fabric of it. Because so, like, so much of settler thought around queerness and reintegration is around tolerance. And I just hate, I almost used the curse word. I don't know if you're allowed to use curse words on your podcast.
I feel the same way. I'm like, tolerance is, I mean, you know, I was raised in a very religious community, and that's kind of what they always taught us around the queer community, was about, like, love and tolerance. And it made me so sad, because I just do not have any room in my heart for, like tolerating queer people. When I, you know, I'm queer, and I'm like, my queer community is such a vibrant part of my life, and and my son's life, and so many of my, I mean, I don't have room to tolerate. I only have room to, like, celebrate and love, or drama, or anger, you know, all those
You know, but tolerance
is personal, though. It's not, tolerance isn't personal. And my queer community,
it's also just personal. Such a, it's literally an inch away from disgust, you know? Tolerance is me being on a flight and being nauseous but not vomiting, you know? Like, and that to me is like, well, should I just not exist? Would that just make your life easier? So I don't want to be tolerated. I want to be seen as integral and valuable in my community. And I want all the queer people in my community to be seen in the same way. So what we've been doing is we've been having conversations, and we've been talking about, like, what does it mean to be Catawba and queer? Like, what are we bringing to our communities? And it's been really interesting being older and looking back, but I actually had a ton of queer role models in my family and in my tribe. And even though I come from a very Mormon community, I come from a very South Carolina conservative community, there was this kind of, I guess I'll say, like, kind of laissez-faire attitude towards sexuality, where it's like, okay, you do your own thing, like, that's okay. But what we're talking about now is, like, yeah, we can do our own thing, but also the perspectives that we bring are deeply useful. Like, I see all of these, like, horrible gender dynamics cropping up in my community and other Native communities, and also just in settler society all the time, where men and women, self-identified men and women, are just having such conflict. And as a queer person, I'm like, what are you fighting about? Like, this is the silliest thing in the world. Why can't you just have a conversation? And so we're in this process of creating language around our role in society. And that's what you see in Indigenous communities across so-called North America, across the Americas, and across the world, is over and over again, not accepting the idea that certain people should be shunned from society, rather that all people who are in a society have a right to be there. And what we need to do is figure out what that role is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've seen the, you know, the work that you've done so much has been about bridging gaps and communicating using humor, using, you know, your amazing talents and your voice and your performance skills. And I think I love the way that you're able to sort of talk to these, you know, tense issues, like issues that have a lot of energy around them, with a real playful like spirit. I'm thinking a lot about the piece that you did at a museum where you were talking about some of the portraits. I don't know, bring me there. I want to know.
Yeah.
I'd like to actually do that performance because I got to read about it. I didn't get to experience it. I would love to kind of know what that was like to be in those rooms, to have those. That's a pretty intimate space to be able to talk about those issues through performance. Maybe you have a little bit of separation as a character or as a performer, but you're really kind of putting yourself out there. So I'd love to dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So the piece you're talking about is called, I called it the Indigenous Core of Discovery, which a lot of people don't know. The Lewis and Clark Expedition was officially titled The Core of Discovery by Thomas Jefferson. Yeah. And so, you know, there is this dynamic that we're so accustomed to of like, non-natives exploring native communities. And so I kind of wanted to turn that on its head and look at how when a lot of the time when indigenous people go into museum spaces, particularly spaces that are so-called dedicated to history, it feels like we're walking into a foreign land that is, even though it might be discussing the very lands that we're from, the perspectives are so radically, unbelievably alien to the reality of our experiences. So in 2016, I got a grant from a fantastic organization called Humanity in Action to conduct unsettling tours of the Smithsonian's Presidential Portrait Gallery
in a great name.
Washington, D.C. Yes. And so this was supposed to coincide with the lead up to the election in 2016. And so the idea was I was using the form of tour, right? The performative script of tour guiding as a way of bringing people into the relationships that these presidents have had with native communities. So when I'm being playful, I usually say, you know, I walk through and I was like, this asshole did this, this asshole did this, this asshole did this. But I really wanted to get deeper into how these presidents were interacting. And I think one great example is we start the tour in front of this larger than life portrait of Andrew Jackson. Because when you talk to people in the United States who are not Native about presidents and Native Americans, their first two questions are who is the worst and who is the best, right? We have this need to put the guilt onto an individual as a way of abdicating ourselves and our society and our governance and our structures from
our ancestors,
from that.
Right? Like no one in my family did that.
Oh, no, I wasn't me. It was just that Andrew Jackson guy.
Right.
And so my favorite story to tell from that was actually a story that you had first introduced to me, which was the story of Andrew Jackson adopting Lynn Coya, who was this Creek child who... I mean, the way that he met Lynn Coya was after his army massacred a village and this child was found nursing on his dead mother's breast. And the soldier brought him to Andrew Jackson and was like, what should we do with this child? And Andrew Jackson writes to his wife, Rachel, and says, I'm sending on this young Indian boy that we might make him part of the family. And that is such an unsettling piece of the narrative that we have about Andrew Jackson as just being genocidal. But the reality is that he was deeply a product of the political dynamics of his time. And so he was he believed that the way to deal with the quote unquote Indian problem, which, you know, has been the problem for the United States for a long time, which is Indians have land and we want the land. And so how do we deal with that problem? And his approach to it was, let's assimilate them. And this was the approach that Thomas Jefferson had. This was the approach that George Washington had. It was very popular at the time. But from the time that he adopted Lynn Coya as a baby to the time that Lynn Coya died at 16 in the 1920s, Andrew Jackson had completely changed his policy to one of removal. And that was partly because of the relationship he had with these settlers. So anyways, these tours I was giving, we're trying to talk about these different presidents. And I was pointing out, for example, that when we think about the Trail of Tears, we think about Andrew Jackson, but he was merely the first president to implement that policy. Practically every president up until Teddy Roosevelt oversaw their own removal of tribes, including Abraham Lincoln, who oversaw the Longest Walk, which is a deeply traumatizing moment for Navajo Nation. And so what I wanted to instill in people is that Native American history is not an addendum to United States history. It is not something that you can add on. It is essential to how the United States was formed, both politically, but also geographically. Like, the shape of the United States is reliant on the theft of native land. And so when I talk about this, a lot of people don't view this performance as being a tour. They don't view this tour as being a performance, but I definitely see it that way because I was a tour guide at Vanderbilt, and, you know, humor, the joy, like, these things are the kind of building blocks of a successful tour. And so in these tours, I'm telling these horrific things that have happened to our communities, but I'm also smiling and I'm laughing. And I think that that combination of horror and joy or lightness was what was so deeply unsettling to a lot of people who came on the tour. I think the really interesting part of this is that when I went to the Smithsonian and I said, hey, I'm doing these tours, I would love to like put up a sign so that if people want to come on this tour, they can. And basically the Smithsonian came back and said, we can't put up your sign, but we also can't stop you from doing this tour. Right, and right. So I was like, great. Well, I'm going to implement a deep critique of the Smithsonian as part of my tour. And so we did the tours all the way up till the election in November 2016. I, like a lot of people, thought that, you know, Hillary Clinton was going to win. But after she lost that night and I heard Rudy Giuliani get on the air and say, this is the greatest victory for average Americans since the election of Andrew Jackson. You know, I was like, what?
Yeah, I know. That was so surreal.
And then an hour later, he says the exact same thing. And then the next morning, he doubles down on it again. And I was like, I just have to keep doing these tours. So I kept doing them all the way up until inauguration week. 2017. But yeah, kind of, that was kind of the project that I think you were.
Yeah. Wow. What an incredible project. Obviously I wish I had been on one of your tours. And an interesting fact, the way that I found out about Lincoya is I went to Andrew Jackson's home in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hermitage. And, I didn't go on a tour because I was kind of being like, you know, I don't want to go on a tour. I want to explore this myself, you know, and I was going and reading all the wall texts and like trying, I guess I was like trying to find the dirt, you know, or maybe the angry way of like moving through that space or something. I don't know, just like feeling really unsettled and angry. And then I read a bit of wall text which had a very passing reference to this Lincoya, didn't say anything about him, and finally the woman who had done her tour came back to me and she's like, you didn't want to do the tour. And I was like, that's right, I did it.
Correct.
Can I ask you this question about Lincoya? And she had so much information and actually brought you know, I made an appointment with her and she and then with her boss and the entire docent community of the Hermitage had these just files and files and files of information about enslaved people and about Lincoya, all this information that they said, look, no one cares about this. We want to tell people about these things, but like most people come and they don't really care. But the fact that you care, they were just so incredible. And it was so the opposite of what I had expected. Like, I was like, I don't want to do your tour. That's going to be, I just assumed that it's going to be narrow-minded, or I assumed it was going like one way. And instead it can be something really powerful and subversive. And these women were doing that amazing Southern thing of walking that line, you know, and like, you know, telling people things that they expect to hear and then trying to surprise them with things that they didn't. And it's a tough thing to do. And yet that's the kind of work that so many of our cultural workers do. Right? Which is,
well, there's this way in which tours can either be used to further mythologize certain things. And that's absolutely, I've never gone on a tour at the Hermitage, but that's exactly what I assumed would have been happening there.
Right.
But then it's like through the medium of tour, like through this performance of tour, like what can we do with the people that are coming on this tour? Because, you know, I think for a lot of people, they think that performance is someone on a stage and other people watching them. but there's a lot of possibility there in terms of interacting with people and really like getting them to think deeply about it. Because one of the other things we talked about was, Andrew Jackson, quote unquote, adopted Lincoln, but the legal concept of adoption wasn't around until the late 1850s. And so, you know, what he was doing was not what we would consider adoption nowadays, right? Like what he was doing was really common practice amongst plantation owners. And even his like phrase, make them part of the family. Like he viewed like this agrarian plantation owner viewpoint during the time was that even the people that they enslaved were quote unquote part of the family, because in their viewpoint, there is someone at the top of the family, aka the white heterosexual male landowner, and then all these other people below them that are quote unquote part of the family, and yet also simultaneously a type of property. And so just because he adopted Lincoya does not mean that he saw Lincoya as being his equal or being capable of becoming his equal. And so through these tours, we can kind of, again, unsettle those expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the way of using the tour in museums has been used by a lot of performance artists, right?
Yes.
And I'm even thinking of I've heard different variations on this, you know, art myth of Jeff Koons pretending to be Salvador Dali and giving museum tours, right? So it's just like it's a kind of an interesting, you know, and then we have other people who've done it in a more formal aspect, but I think it's a really interesting form to say, just even if you're not being toured and you assume that you're discovering on your own, quote unquote, on your own at a museum like the Smithsonian or anything else, nothing is an accident, right? Everything has a type of a plan. It's serving a certain type of story to an audience that's expected to be a certain, I think an agenda is maybe too heavy handed to say it, but it's, you know, the way in which we're displaying and experiencing art isn't an accident. And I love that tours make that really explicit, sometimes in stereotypical ways, but sometimes in really unexpected ways as well.
These museums are in essence a type of technology, like a type of a way in which society is able to formalize its history. And you see that also in the history of museums. Like early 1900s, museums were just basically rooms with a bunch of objects in them. And then over the last 100 or so years, you see the ways in which you get this curator class that's developed. You get this idea of the ways that museums start getting involved in narratives. And you can see that in museums that have or have not engaged in this kind of reflective process over the last 20 or 30 years. Because like I was at the Science Museum in Cleveland, and it was just like they had this giant mural that was about quote unquote progress. And on one end were the, you know, loincloth clad Native Americans. And on the other end are like astronauts.
I absolutely love that mural, by the way. Like,
it's right? Unbelievable. It's so good. It's so good. It's so terrible.
It's like a comic book. It's really like it flattens everything into comic book. But I always just read it. I mean, because, you know, I like to rewrite my own experiences so that I enjoy them. So I was just like, wow, natives are in space too, man. Like we're the
of course we are.
And we're the alpha and the omega. Because like obviously native people in those spacesuits, like right? Like I'm
of
not
course.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was a interesting experience. I've also reprised the tour at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts, which was like a really great experience because they had a exhibit from the Buffalo Bill Wild West Center called Go West. And so I did a tour called Don't Go West.
Oh, you're like, and the South is fine.
yeah. You can go South, maybe North. No. I mean, it was interesting because also my tribe is very Mormon. And so there's actually a good number of Catawbas who are in Utah, who are around this institution of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. And so it was really interesting to be there and I also felt uncomfortable about it. Like one of the things that I begin in my tour with is that I am just speaking about my experience. Like I do not speak for Indian country. I do not even speak for my tribe. Absolutely. All I can do is tell you the story that I see when I look at these objects, when I look at these histories. And I always end my tours with imploring people to go and find lots of diverse indigenous voices, because I'm someone who gets to move through the world with the privilege of being seen as a white person, as a cisgender male. So my experiences are also really constructed around privilege, but like, we need to be talking to genderqueer natives. We need to be talking to Black natives. We need to be talking to all of these diverse native people to get their understanding of the story, because we're not homogenous peoples. I think we're really comfortable talking about that in terms of like, we have 570 plus tribes. Like, we all have different experiences, but we also need to talk about that within our communities. Like, there are Black Catawbas, and like, my experience is going to be radically different from their experience. And the only way we're going to be able to move forward with understanding is by giving space for the plurality of those stories. And so I'm hoping kind of the next step of this project is going to be providing resources and platforms to lots of diverse Native people, to give them these opportunities to go in and kind of unsettle the institutions that are around them and that are kind of structuring their lives. But yeah, I think that's the piece of it that feels the most important to me, is that I'm just telling a story that I know. And there's a lot more stories out there that we got to listen to.
I really am still struck by like the simplicity of the approach of just using the tour, your voice, your language in presence with the other people there, because I think I see a lot of, you know, proposals that are like, we're going to need, you know, AR overlay over all of these older institutions, or VR installations, or, you know, audio tours that can scale in all this different direction. And I like the idea of just like, you know, you can invite people from the community to give alternative tours, and they can, and that can be okay. There doesn't have to be sort of the massive new technology that overlays it. And with, again, that can kind of flatten the experience by saying, okay, you know, allowing it to be more of a platform to have multiple voices could even be more exciting. What could you imagine? I don't know, you know, like in that perfect dream world where you get the amazing grant, or you get the amazing, I don't know, you strike the oil that you're looking for. What would you imagine the ideal experience, whether it's in museums or even in places like theater, because I know you've done a lot of work, you know, in the traditional spaces of performance, that could bring in new audiences to have the kind of experience of plurality like you're describing?
Yeah. You know, and this has been a challenge that I've received, particularly from women, Native artists and scholars, and I really appreciate this challenge, which is, so much Native art has been focused on critique of the institution. Like, oh my gosh, I feel so bad because I'm forgetting his name right now, but his artifact piece, he's Luis Cienyo.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, James Luna. Thank you. Yeah, so like, so much Native art has been focused on critiquing the institutions. And what I see a lot of, particularly women and queer curators and museum workers and artists, is this pushing for us to stop referencing these institutions. Like, what happens when we stop critiquing them and just start building our own institutions? Like, what does art look like when I'm not trying to address what the Smithsonian is doing, when I'm not trying to address what these giant art institutions are doing, but rather I'm investing time and energy and resources into building the institutions, the community of my tribe and of other indigenous tribes? And it's felt kind of uncomfortable, which, like, that's great. Like, please make me uncomfortable, because I do want to think about, you know, please, that's my request every day.
I mean, I don't know. But it's kind of like, why not both, though? Because, like, I'm very much in the, like, DJ. I mean, like, oh, God, embarrassing that I'm admitting that I'm a DJ. But I'm just saying that, like, I like sampling. I like, you know, I like mixing.
Yes.
I like saying, okay, I can add something new, but I also love this old thing. And also I can critique that old thing. And I can say, this is problematic. And also I still love it. I don't know. You know, like, that's okay.
Yes.
And I, there's something really incredible about these old institutions and these models that maybe can become fertile ground for reimagining or springboards. And I don't know, I guess I would push back and say, like, why not both?
Yeah, you're totally right.
Yeah.
And there's also just the reality that these institutions have a lot of resources and power. And so, you know, as much as I might build up my tribal cultural center, which is where I've worked for the last 2 years and now I'm a consultant for, like, as much as I do that work, like, the reality is that most people are going to these non-Catawba institutions in South Carolina, and those institutions are pushing narratives about us. And so we do need, there is a need to intervene in those institutions.
Well, yeah, and also we can kind of feel in a little bit insider too, right? Like, we're like, oh, we're so over critiquing these systems, we can kind of explode and move into other areas. And yet if the mainstream community is still used to experiencing and having conversations in older formats, that could still be interesting, right? Like, in some ways you might jump too far ahead where you're only talking to a very small group of insiders, which I don't find fertile. That's just me. Like, if I don't feel like an average person from my tribe could discover what I'm doing, and I feel a little bit like maybe I'm too in my own art, you know, fancy little world or something, right? Because it can even exclude people from our own tribes, right? It could even exclude like, well, wait a minute, I thought if I wanted to see art, I go to a museum, and I want to be the last person to say, no, that's so dumb. Nowadays we're in VR, you know, like, I want to be like, no, of course, yes, and right, like, yes, and also in VR, right?
And there's also value, like, our kids, like, in my community, our kids are having to live in the public schools. And so there is something, like, really deeply gratifying and empowering about, like, seeing Catawbas in their textbooks and seeing Catawbas at the museums that they go to on field trips.
Absolutely.
That feels really important to me. Like, to this day, one of the most vivid cultural experiences of mine was when my class went to our cultural center for a program. And, you know, I'm just sitting there with the other kids, and the drummers and dancers say, oh my gosh, Rue, it's so good to see you here. Like, come up and drum with us. And that, like, felt empowering in a way that having a separate experience away from my classmates wouldn't necessarily feel like that. And then I look at some of these musicians. So specifically I'm thinking about Frank Wallen and A Tribe Called Red, and the way that they're able to take this degrading material and flip it on its head, sample it, like you were saying, you know, sample it into something that is empowering and that is powerful, because the reality is that those disempowering narratives, images, music and stories have been a part of our experience. And so the power of taking those and saying, no, this is wrong, here's the reality, and I'm going to take that reality and I'm going to turn it into a banger, you know, a song that just slaps.
Totally.
Like, that is amazing. And that is, I think you're exactly right. Like, it's not a critique or building. It's like, how do we do both simultaneously?
Yeah, and I kind of feel like interesting artwork has always been in that in-between space. I'm so biased because that's just the work that really vibes with me. Like, when I see an artist that's saying, like, I'm doing a side eye to this, building this, it's like this maybe the approach of, like, you know what, I have two turntables and a microphone and I'm creating my own medium, but I'm still doing a nod to jazz. I'm still doing a nod to poetry. I'm still saying these other things were part of the fertile ground, but I also don't need the permission to do it. Right. And I like that. I'm just going
to
always,
well, I think that,
like,
refusal to ask permission is unsettling even of itself. Like, I see so many non-native artists who are so consumed with permission structures around art institutions. And then I see, like, native artists and Black artists and Latinx artists, like, who are just like, no, I'm gonna sample the Mona Lisa and I'm gonna do some, like, cool shit with that, and not wait for an institution to tell me whether or not I can I can do that. I think that's like so invigorating.
Yeah. Yeah. What things are exciting you lately? Like in either in the weirdo or boring or normie pop culture or, or, you know, in the high, you know, fine art or intellectual space, what actually are you binging right now in the possibly self-quarantine state of 2020?
Yeah, I'm so binging science fiction writing right now, and particularly the indigenous and Black futurisms. I think those are roadmaps to a future, and to a future that doesn't feel dismal. I mean, there's this great book called Love Beyond All Space and Time that was compiled by a bunch of awesome queer indigenous sci-fi writers that is just, I keep coming back to it because it's such a good, it's such a great way to break out of this very moment that I feel stuck in, and seeing that so much is possible. And I see this happening so often in music and literature and activism, where people are really stuck in this idea that we are moving from a moment in the past of like women being oppressed and queer people being oppressed, and we're moving into a moment of liberation. And what's so useful about these, particularly indigenous futurists, is we are not, that is not the story of this land. Like the land that I am sitting on right now, that is not the story of my land. The story of my land is Catawba women being powerful in a way that was almost incomprehensible to Europeans, and through the violent act of colonization being repressed. And even in that moment, Catawba women finding ways of maintaining their sovereignty and their community recognizing their sovereignty. And that maybe at this moment that we're in, we might be getting back to a place where Catawba women can again exercise their power and their sovereignty. But that is not a historical exception. That is maybe just a returning to something that happened before. And so that kind of just like big thinking, like everything is possible. There's so much that has happened. Like I listen to all these indigenous people from all across the United States and elsewhere, and the experiences that they've had as communities point to radical possibilities in terms of how we can relate to each other, and importantly, how we can relate to the land. Like, I see these environmentalists, and they're still really stuck in this technology versus nature binary. And that is just
such... As if one came from somewhere else, right?
Yes!
Yeah.
Yes!
They're not part of the same thing. Yeah.
Well, I had someone that I was working on for a garden design, like they were telling me, you know, well, what would have happened if it wasn't colonization? Like, how else could have it unfolded? I was like, imagine a situation in which indigenous communities in the United States are able to communicate with people in Europe and like share these ideas. And instead of just imposing kind of an industrial revolution that's based on extraction on the lands of the United States, what if instead we were able to move through this quote unquote industrial revolution and this technological revolution with the central concept that nature is not something we can compromise on? Like the relationships that we have with the rest of the world, the non-human world, are things that we can't compromise on. Like, how would our housing structures look different? How would our energy infrastructure look different? How would our roads and transportation look different? So I'm like very much stuck in this realm of science fiction at the moment because I'm so exhausted by reality.
Fair. And I honor that. I think it's interesting that a lot of similarities between maybe Afrofuturism and Native futurism is sometimes a radical redefinition of the past, or I would say like a radical connection to the truth of the past, right? It's like maybe not buying the spin. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting because it, like, I love that kind of energy you have around imagining what what our cities would look like, what our mm-hmm. land would look like, what our resources would look like if contact had happened in a different way or on different yeah. terms. But also it's just saying, what if what you think about the past is a question mark? Like, what if there's a different way of approaching that? And then therefore it already leads to a different type of future that can be imagined, because we do run into a lot of exhaustion where people say, I just can't possibly imagine how we can solve the issues that we're facing. And when you can't imagine it, you push towards accelerationism, right? Like, you push towards, yeah. well, I guess we should just all like either give up or, you know, like run it to the ground so we can start anew, or all these other like really ridiculous things.
And how heartbreaking, like right? that you can't imagine. Like, that to me is the greatest evidence for why we need native storytellers in every school system, in every class, coming in and reminding people that there are other ways that history could have unfolded. Because such as, and I'm going to briefly go off to a historical story because I think it's so illuminating. Like, we are so reliant in the United States on the idea that colonization was the only thing that could have happened. And yet we ignore one of the most important early stories of quote unquote colonization, which is the story of the colony of Roanoke. And if you don't know the story, like, or I'm speaking to your listeners, if you don't know the story, go and look it up. The way I was taught it as someone in South Carolina, this was a story in so-called North Carolina. The way I was taught was, you know, Sir Walter Raleigh brought over these people and they started this colony, and then he left. He was going to go back to Europe and like get some resources and then come back. And when he came back, they were all gone. And all that was there was the word Croatoan carved into a tree. And the way it was presented to me was this giant mystery. The reality is that it was really well documented that these people were in a village, were so miserable and so cold and so sick and so hungry, and yet they saw just down the road a tribal community that was flourishing. And so they were like, oh, we're going to go hang out with them. And I just think about that moment, and I think about like the women who were in this like European colony who were suddenly in a matriarchal community and like suddenly respected and not treated like a body could be transgressed upon.
Right. And we wonder why they didn't come back.
Right. Literally. And when you look at early laws in like the Massachusetts colony, South Carolina colony, it was common to put laws in that said, you will be put in jail if you try and leave our colony for a tribal community. Because so often these settlers could see that it was better to be in these tribal communities. But that is not the story we tell, because it's so important to the story of the United States that we think that the only thing that could have happened was the violent dispossession of indigenous lands.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in, you know, in upstate New York, and mm-hmm. my mother was education director at a place called Ganondagam, which was a Haudenosaunee or Iroquois city, which was the largest city in, you know, in the Northeast at the time. It was a massive city when we had contact. And one of the sort of famous stories we have, and actually the director of the of Ganondagan is a descendant of a woman named Mary Jameson, who there was an armed conflict between the Mohawk and a settler group, and she was adopted by the Mohawk and was raised as a Mohawk woman. And again, through another, like the French and Indian War, found again herself displaced and then re-entered European culture and wrote this, you know, famous book in the 1700s about her life as a Haudenosaunee woman, and never minced words about how wonderful it was and how happy she was and how, you know, like incredible it was and what she learned. And, you know, and she lived in time of war. And so it was, you know, there was entry and exit points that were really difficult. And yet she was able to, because she was, you know, a blonde haired woman, able to kind of be an advocate and talk about the culture in this way and go to Europe and kind of advocate and talk and say, this is my lived experience. And that was an incredibly well documented space, which helped our tribe have a lot of maybe things on the record around our language, mm-hmm. around time periods or things like mm-hmm. that, because she mm-hmm. was this white woman, right? Who got to mm-hmm. experience what mm-hmm. it was and then explain it. It's really fascinating. But I was very inspired by that as a child, just saying like, wow, this is interesting that we got to have that out. I mean, she's barely an outsider because she was a member of our tribe, but just to having reading her kind of broken English testament about it, which is really mm-hmm. incredible, right?
And yeah, and there's these ways in which it gives such great evidence to why contemporary ideas of blood quantum and biological descendancy are not, in my opinion, I deeply respect the sovereignty of every tribal community to determine their citizenship standards, but to me it's like we really need to have a deep conversation about what it means to be a member of our communities that is not based on biologics and genetic logics, because what I see over and over again is that that's just not how my ancestors and ancestors of other tribes were viewing belonging.
Right. And then we also have this weird thing. I mean, I don't know. I'm just going to throw this out there, and it's okay if you toss it right back and be like, I don't even want to touch that. But like, I don't know. Has this happened to you? Has this happened to you? Recently, it's happened to me quite frequently where people are saying, you know, Amelia, like, I know that you're Native, and recently I've gotten a DNA test turned into. What do we do? Like, I don't even know what to say. I'm just always kind of like, okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, a great person for anyone who's listening to go and check out is Dr. Kim Tallbear. Her kind of most famous work, I think, is about Native American DNA, and it's called literally Native American DNA. And she was looking at like how DNA genetic science is kind of the new era of racial science. And really just does such a great job of talking through DNA science and blood quantum. But in terms of my lived experience, it is so common for people to say this. Not even, like, I'll go somewhere and I'll be like, I'm Catawba. And then people will be like, oh my gosh, I took a DNA test and I'm 5% Native American. And it's like, not the same thing. Like, I can take a DNA test that'll show me that I'm 20% British or English. I was not able to vote in Brexit. Like, my opinion on Brexit is deeply irrelevant to the reality of Brexit. So I don't understand why you're like pushing this on me. But on top of it, in like kind of a logistical governmental sense, we get so many calls in my tribe at our institutions from people who have taken genetic tests and who live in the Carolinas, who are just certain that they have an ancestor who is Catawba, and they want to know what kind of benefits they can get because they took this DNA test.
Oh my God. I wish it was like they wake up and they're in a robe and they open their front door and there's 12 people from the tribe with a giant oversized check. And they're like,
oh my gosh, we're so happy you called us.
You just won $1 million.
Oh my gosh, we're so happy to meet you again.
Everyone gets a car. Like,
you get a car, you get a car, you get per cap, you get per cap.
No one has to pay for college. All of the kids' health care is going to be taken care of. Like, I mean, truly, right? Like, truly, if the world was, you know, a magical place, that would be true, right? Like, being there, right, would be like the jackpot. You hit it, mm-hmm. you know, because it is. It, you know, right, culturally speaking, right? I mean, I'm like very proud.
Yes, of course. I get it.
Right, I get it.
This is what I've said as I traveled to, you know, Nashville for college. I was in New York the summer that we worked on our research fellowship. I was in DC. I lived in Berlin. And the thing that I see over and over again is a young generation that doesn't have a sense of place. And I feel so deeply lucky because I've always known where my landscape is, which is Catawba land. Like, I know that this is my land. And I understand why people are jealous of that, because in this world, it is so hard to have that kind of certainty. And coming from my community, we do have that kind of certainty. never left this land. And there is something so deeply gratifying about that relationship. And so I get why people, even beyond, you know, perceived BS benefits, why they want to have that kind of connection. But it's like, no, you have to create those connections with the landscapes yourselves. Like, you don't have access to our inherited relationship with our landscapes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we've all met great allies in our lives, right? Who look at themselves and say, like, I have a connection to this land. Mm-hmm. I am going to find a way in which I can find other like-minded people and we can support each other with mutual trust and understanding rather than, you know, colonizing it, taking mm-hmm. it or appropriating it. And it is a way, and at the end of the day, it's not our responsibility, right, to empower people to go on that journey, because it's up to them and it's up to their white community or their, you know, there are people of all different types of backgrounds that have kind of, you know, I've had this conversation with, they haven't just been white, who are saying, I want to go on this and embark this trip of finding my history and my connection to this place. And it really is their journey. Right. And mm-hmm. I think as a Native person, we'll always support good allies. But at the end of the day, it's like one of those things where you're like, this is your journey. It's not mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and for so many, I mean, the most common white ancestry in the Carolinas is Irish and Scots-Irish. And when you look at the history of settler colonialism, these were not communities that were like privileged, you know, that they weren't on the best parts of the boats when they were traveling from Europe. Like, these were people who were colonized by Britain and then transformed into settlers through settler colonialism. And so what I'm always saying to them is, like, you need to dig into that history. Like, you need to look at the ways that your ancestors were dispossessed and then forced into the dispossession of indigenous peoples. And I think the other part of it is also, like, settlers are often really anxious that indigenous people are going to do to them what they did to us, which is to remove them from the landscape.
Yeah.
But indigenous scholars have responded to this claim over and over again, which is, no, you have a right to be here, but you also have an obligation to be in good relationships with everything else that is on this landscape. And that is what we're asking of you, is that you be in good relationship and that we all together work towards the resurgence of the landscapes that we're sharing. And I think that if we can just get to that point where we're not constantly addressing settler anxieties, but we're able to, like, really enter into that space of allyship, yes, but also relationship building. Like, where I want to go is that we're building families across these identity boundaries, and we're building families that are based on all of our relationships with landscape. Like, I think that's where we have to go with this, particularly in this moment of climate crisis and climate chaos.
Yeah, we don't really have maybe the luxury of saying we all can do it in a different way, because we're all in it together.
Mm-hmm. We're all in it together, which is making me think about the coronavirus, COVID-19.
Oh, how are you doing?
I'm fine. I'm probably one of the most well-traveled people in my community. And so there's a bit of a, like, typhoid Mary. well, like, everyone is like, oh, don't, like, shake hands with Rue, because he's like the most likely person to carry it.
He probably was in Europe.
And I see this kind of app. And I see, like, people... Well, I see, like, young people being really flippant about the outcomes of this virus. And this is not Catawbas in particular, but just, like, young people in the United States. And what I'm really concerned about is our elders, because this is what I keep hearing from health professionals, is that this is not a test of whether or not you think you're going to be okay. This is a test about your solidarity with communities, because I might be fine, but I also might still be a carrier. And so, like, what does it say if I go to New York and then immediately come home and then go and, like, hang out with all the elders in my community? Like, that is deeply irresponsible of me. I also think what it lays bare is the ways in which corporations, businesses, utility companies are constantly trying to keep disabled people out of the workplace and out of business by saying that like teleworking is not possible. And I think you and anyone who's been like in the technology world have known for a long time that that's just BS. Like you can telework. Like that is just so obviously something you can do. But to suddenly see all of these institutions, like my alma mater, Vanderbilt University, canceling classes for the rest of the semester and doing them all online. It's like, you could have been doing this for not just disabled students, but something that I'm looking at right now, like as someone who is deeply interested in graduate school, what I see is like, there's so many incentives for me to leave my community to go and work on a graduate degree, which I want to do. I want to get a graduate degree, but I don't want to leave my community. Yeah. And so I'm thinking about like indigenous and local communities and the ways that like young people are often given this choice between leave and pursue this degree or stay and, you know, quote unquote fester and not like developing the skill. And so I don't know. That's kind of where my mind is around this coronavirus, is it just like really lays bare all of the BS assumptions that we've been forced to accept for so long.
Yeah, I kind of am really into that meme that's going around. That's like, I guess we could find out which one of these meetings could have been an email. And I'm like, well,
yes, yes.
I mean, I live in Oakland, California, and I work in San Francisco and at a tech company. And, I think work was canceled and mandated from home, you know, not canceled, but mandated from home for many of the big tech companies weeks ago. And it slowly is starting to kind of move across, my community of friends, but I still have a lot of friends that are not able to work from home. And not because of any reason, except that their institutions had never thought about it. Mm-hmm. Really. And at tech companies, they're like, hey, this is like literally not a big deal because, you know, in some departments, the entire team is distributed. In other departments, right, people have never worked in the office. And in other departments, you know, we have kind of you can work from home any amount of days you want, right? And you know, tech companies are exceptionally privileged in that way, that the way in which we work is, you know, digitally native by definition. But it is starting to shake other institutions by saying like, well, why haven't you thought of these, features or these abilities? And that is my deepest wish, is that maybe at the end of this test of the emergency broadcast system, we realize that, wow, you know, maybe it's not only possible, but it also means that it's possible for other people we thought couldn't join and become really valued members of this community can. And I hope those barriers, of course, I have very few like mom friends who are out there saying, I have no idea how to work from home. You know, they're all like, they're great. They're in their zone. They already have everything organized. They're like, I know how to do this. Are you kidding me? Oh, the kid's no longer in school. Yeah, I'm good. I already know how to do this.
I'm really liking the meme that's like, introverts, this is your time to shine. And I'm like, yes, I've been training for this moment. I mean, and, you know, of course, recognizing people in the service industry, and I think it also, like, calls in question our healthcare system and all these things where it's, like, this moment lays bare, like, why all these social institutions are really essential. But I think I want to, like focus in on what you're talking about like the tech industry knows that you don't need to be physically present to be a valuable member of a team. And thinking about, like we talk about this in terms of indigenous communities, like so many, again, like so many indigenous young people feel like they have to leave their communities to be able to access these economic opportunities. Like to me, like this is such a fruitful opportunity for tech industries and indigenous communities to collaborate, because if we put into place the internet infrastructure in these tribal communities, in our tribal communities, which, you know, put a pin in it, but Native communities have some of the lowest accesses to internet of any community in the United States. You know, that is something we have to address. But this might actually be one of the greatest opportunities for growing diverse teams within the tech industry, which is all of these indigenous people, these young indigenous people who are looking for opportunities, who also are reticent to leave their communities. Like, how can we work with them to address some of these needs in the tech industry? And then I also think about that in relation to queer communities. Like, one project that I'm thinking a lot about is like settler colonialism or colonialism and this need to like remove resources from communities. And if we stop thinking of queer people as being a tolerate, but rather an essential and deeply valuable community for our tribes, like, what does it mean that they feel so deeply that they need to leave our rural and tribal communities to find some kind of liberation? Like, what is happening there? And what are the ways that we can restructure society so that so queer people can stay in their communities? Yeah. And I might feel a little selfish about this because I am like a queer person in rural South Carolina who is like, who is there around here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, right now the whole world is about to find out what that feels like, right? Like, where so mm-hmm. many of us mm-hmm. are in, you know, encouraged isolation, or, you know, whatever all of the sort of buzzwords around talking about, you know, just staying home and working from home, whether you like it or not, is what we're all, you know, kind of mm-hmm. doing, you know, here on the West Coast doing. And I think we're all about to discover how do we keep those social spaces healthy when we don't have close proximity to people. And queer people have found out how to do that online for a long time. I think when I was like a very early, you know, hacker in the 90s, when I was literally just a child, right? Like a child hacking together these systems, which at the time, it was illegal to use any software other than what its use case was, but no one knew what use cases of software was. So we were constantly merging and mixing things together so that we could just talk to each other. So we could just use modems to talk to another person, or to use, telephones that were, you know, public telephones to get into the internet, or all these like kind of weird things we did, you know, when I was like a 11 or 12 year old in the early days of the internet. But we did it because we wanted to talk to people. It wasn't for anything else. I mean, I'm sure there are always bad actors in tech spaces, but sure. most of us kids were just like, I am in suburbia, or I am in rural America, or I'm a different person and I want to find my people. And this younger generation feels very native to finding their own strange weirdos on the internet. And it's like, yeah, how do we bring that into a space that can be healthy and can be connected? And I hope as a community, we figure out how to have meaningful connections online that then lead to really meaningful changes in our local communities rather than isolating us. I know a lot of people, I don't know, ever since I've been 11 or 12, people have said, oh, the internet isolates people. And I was like, that's different than my experience, because I always thought, I go online because I want to talk to my friends. What are you doing online?
Right.
Because I'm talking to my friends. And I think my son would say the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, there is these concerns. Like, we've all been there where we felt like, oh, man, maybe this feeling of connection I have on the internet is one thing, but then being able to actually have, you know, physical contact and be in a room with people is another. And I hope in these times of crisis, we can find out maybe some data, maybe medical information, maybe just loose networks of smart, radical people that can share our experiences and help us hack through it. Because that would be my dream too, would being able to live in rural communities and still have the same kind of excitement that I've had when I lived in Brooklyn or other places, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like being on my land is so, like, my mental health has never been better being back on my land, because I can live with the plants and the animals and the people that feel so central to who I am. But at the same time, like, artistically feeling like really isolated and feeling like I don't have as strong of an artistic community or an intellectual or technological community that I might have if I was living in New York or living on the West Coast, like all these places. And so yeah, I'm hoping that some thought, some data can come out of this experience. But, you know, the last thing I wanted to kind of share with you in terms of projects was this project that I'm working on with Mia Susan Amir and some other really awesome dramaturgs called Unsettling Dramaturgy. So it's bringing together indigenous dramaturgs and theater workers and CRIP or disabled theater workers. And we're spread out across Turtle Island. And so we're using the medium of Zoom and online organizing as a way of having these conversations. And it's just so amazing that we've been talking about this for a year. Like, what are the ways that we can interact? What are the ways that we can build and converse? And not getting maybe the recognition that work deserves. And then suddenly there's a global pandemic and everyone is deeply interested in how to have meaningful conversations through digital technologies. I'm also thinking about the performance piece that I did at the end of the research summer that I had with you in New York, called 803-323-7638, where I had people texting me, you know, deep secrets that they had about their life or things that they were imagining. And what I learned from that was that we society or popular narratives really want to lean towards either techno-optimism, you know, technology is going to fix everything, or techno-pessimism, technology is destroying everything. And the reality is that, yeah, like the conversation that you and I are having at this very moment is obviously going to be different than if you and I were sitting in the same physical space. But it doesn't make one or the other less real or less valuable. It is just a different way of relating with people. And so this has to be a part of our social toolbox. Like, how do we have conversations digitally? How do we have conversations in person? How do we have conversations over the phone? Like this is just another piece of our social toolkit that we have to be developing within ourselves and within our communities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That project sounds incredible. I have one of my first friends that I made here since moving. I'm new to the West Coast. I'm new to Oakland. And one of the first friends I made in near Oakland is a city, Berkeley. And I made a friend, Nicole Newham, who was talking to me about this film that she was working on. Mm. And it was called Crip Camp. And as she talked to me about it, it was, about a camp that was for, differently abled people in the 70s. It was run by hippies. And I was like, wait a minute. I know about this. I'm so excited about this. Cause I grew up in Rochester. We had Gallaudet University. Mm-hmm. I used to take acting workshops there, and members who are part of that Crip Camp were actually like some of the acting teachers. And she was like, how do you know about this? I'm like, I thought everybody knew about this, but no, it's true. That, like, a lot of people don't know about the interesting radical spaces that the differently abled community has brought us over the years in art and in performance, especially places like Gallaudet University, which have incredible performance programs. That just reminded me of her film. And if you haven't had a chance to see it, it's pretty inspiring to think about. That's obviously a very in-person, experience, and they definitely use their bodies as ways of protesting by living in spaces and in the center floor and whatnot. But I do think a lot about that we have members of our communities who know how to do these things, who know how to communicate. I liked that part in the film Crip Camp where they were like, they cut off the phones and thought we didn't know how to communicate. Well, guess what? We're deaf and we know how to sign through the windows. And I was like, that's amazing.
Oh my God.
Like, right. So there's, there are members of our community that are like, no, I communicate over Zoom all the time because I'm a single mom, or because I'm differently abled, or because I live in a rural space, or or I'm a computer programmer, so I just push code and no one ever needs to even see my face. They just know my handle and they know they can track what code changes I'm making, right? So we have members of our community that know how to do these things. And it's exciting to be able to sync up with them and learn about how to
learn.
Yeah, learn.
I mean, again, it's like tolerance. What a useless this idea. Like, let's lean on one another.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. What an incredible thing to imagine that, like, not only do you have to tolerate someone, but this person could save your life, right? This
yes.
person could really make your life funny. They could bring joy mm-hmm. to your community. That's a better place to get.
What I always say is Indigenous youth are going to save the world, whether you like it or not.
They're literally the best. Thank you so much, Rue, for having this conversation with me. And I just love hearing about all the incredible things that you're up to. I hope this isn't the last time we have a conversation. I want to do it again and keep in touch. And
oh my gosh,
anytime. Some of the other incredible, you know, Indigenous people that are on this podcast or just out in the world. You know, once we're all allowed out of our houses again, I can just see you. Or not, maybe we'll become virtual beings and have
yes.
cakes together or all the things
oh my God.
We can do. But I wanted to give you a moment if there's anything else that I've like forgotten to ask you about or anyone else you wanted to make sure that you shouted out or mentioned to give you space to do that.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate you having me on and just like hearing your voice again and like catching up with you. It's been really great because again, like you were so formative in my development as an artist and an educator. So it's just been, it's really great to like see your continuing exploration of form and mode and education and seeing where curiosity takes you, because it's been a great encouragement to me to not like settle on a decided form. And again, like I said at the beginning, like you were the only Native professor that I had. And I think that it's a great testament to why we need Native mentors in spaces, because I feel like what we were able to do is we didn't have to explain our experiences to one another, and we could just move to the actual interesting work of like, okay, well, like coming from my community, like this is what I'm thinking. So it's great to have known you then, and it's great to like speak with you right now. And I love the podcast. I'm so excited to see who you bring on next.
Wow, me too. I'm just so lucky to have. I always tell people my only superpower. Like I don't know. I had this dinner with a wonderful friend of mine, Stephanie Dinkins, had an AI dinner, and she asked all the women or you know everyone present to say what your superpower is. Or and I was like, I don't know if I have a superpower. People just invite me to do cool things. Like my superpower is just like get invited.
I don't know. Yes.
But I feel like I want to do that for other people too. I'm like, you know, that's my superpowers. I get invited. So I want to invite other people with better superpowers than me. And you know, we've all been really blessed in our lives to have mentors that understood us at formative times. And for me, I have just an incredible legacy of people that I need to pay it forward to, who've helped me out and seen me when I needed to be seen and challenged me when I needed to be challenged. And so I'm really blessed that I got to have a student like you because I owe so much. you helped me pay down my debt.
Yes. Yes.
So I really appreciate being able to have you in my life and just really making an incredible impact in your community. And so I hope I can continue to support you. And thank you so much for taking this time on this Friday afternoon.
Of course. Well, much love and much love to your son as well. And have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And love to your felines. My feline creature she's been good. She's just been staring at me, but she's been very calm. So thank you.
They're deflated in a circle around me at the very moment.
Of course they are. I mean, you know, you're one of your cats is a tortoise tabby that looks like exactly like mine. And
oh my gosh.
Funny when I see it on Instagram, I'm like, oh my God, they have like
that's your cat.
The same chatty, crazy spirit, which is great.
You have the cat who had an early experience of food insecurity, and so we're working on him not overeating, which has been a struggle.
Oh my God. I've definitely lost that battle with my chubby cat. She is.
Who she is.
Yeah, she also had it.
I know, same.
That's what I'm saying. She's like,
aww.
You're wild.
was so wonderful talking with you. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. And let's keep the conversation going.
Absolutely.
All right. Bye, Amelia.